Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 293 of the Morning Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
We have Mark Rubin online in San Jose, California.
Hello.
All righty. So we had one fact check from last week. You mentioned the Academy Awards, and we've talked about the Academy Awards on Spotcast, and I think the rules changed just last year, but and I've linked here a story that we talked about on the on Spotcast, but you had mentioned that they have to show in a theater of some type for a movie to be qualified to be nominated for Academy Awards. So I know you're hoping for Sonic the Hedgehog to be the clear winner, but it has to. The rule is that they have to have played 7 days in a theatrical run in Los Angeles. That's the minimum. But the story we had from Spotcast, which I've got linked here, talks about how they were changing the rules because of all the Netflix and Amazon Prime and now Apple TV stuff that's been coming out over the last little while. And I think Roma was the movie that was a Netflix release that got nominated in 2019. And it was, so it had to be basically run in Los Angeles for a minimum of a week or seven day run. So to be qualified. So I guess, I don't know, I guess Sonic has had a 7 day run in Los Angeles, right? I mean,
presumably because it had been out for a while. And yeah, the thing we talked about on Spotcast was the Golden Globes or People's Choice. I can't remember which awards right. It was, but it was not the Academy Awards, which as of this recording, I believe has still not made any official guidance for that.
Mm. And is that going to, we don't know if that one's been canceled this year yet. Well, still too early to tell.
I mean, they've gone without, hosts. They might as well just do it all as a big Zoom call and stream it live on YouTube or something. And it wouldn't be that different.
Sure. Okay. All right. So what do we got? We have some Ask MTJC this week as well. I mean,
we do. And it's from Paul Wilkinson, friend of the show, says, Australian retailers, aside from Apple, have dropped the HomePod from $469 Australian to $299, fueling speculation a new model is coming. What's happening in your neck of the woods?
Well, we had that back a few months ago. I guess, was it around Christmas and Black Friday last year? We had, I think Best Buy was selling them for around that price, right? Because I bought one from Otherworld Computing, and it was like a refurb one. But I think you guys both picked up HomePods from Best Buy last year, didn't you?
I did pick one up for $199 US, yes.
$199 US,
yeah. So interestingly enough, after I saw that, I went and did a search to see if I saw any price drops, and I didn't see any in any regular retailers, but I did find this one article saying that Apple actually has dropped the price for employees to $149.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, employees only. Hmm. Not clear what that means.
The $149, that's like half off, right?
That's half, pretty much half price, yeah.
And I did not pick up one. My HomePod is still an only child.
Well, I have have two of them, but they're separated by a floor, so they can't do the stereo thing. Well, they could, but it would sound weird, right?
Yeah. Well, I do have mine stereo connected, and it's really good. If you're interested in good sound, it's definitely worth it.
It'd be interesting to see how that 8D stuff plays on a pair of HomePods with the stereo separation, you know? All right, moving on. All right, so in the follow-up, we've got, I grouped the sort of virus COVID-related stuff to the top of the notes here so we can get them sort of out of the way, if you will. But the first one up is that, and I think this number might have changed since I posted this. This is from Sunday. Apple is producing 1 million face shields for medical workers per week. So Tim Cook took to Twitter and here in this article talking about how they're doing their part to contribute. And quite a few famous people have been donating to the sort of cause around the world. I know that some celebrities have, like, I think it was Blake Lively and that Canadian guy who played Ryan Reynolds. I think they donated some money towards the cause, and I think Bill Gates is doing something. And but have you guys heard anything like that?
Probably to all of those. There's been so many different. not to sound flippant, yeah. But it I know there's been a lot of different things that have happened relating to celebrities, you know, donating or doing things to raise awareness. There's even John Krasinski, who from Jim Halpert from The Office, or I guess if you watch Jack Ryan on Amazon, he's, you know, the secret agent dude. And he started a new YouTube series called So Good News as sort of the counter to that of, like, all right, well, let's talk about some good stuff because you're probably hearing nonstop you know, sad, terrible things. So that's a very long-winded way of saying I would not be surprised that all those things you stated were true, Tim.
True. Okay. Well, it's interesting, too. I was watching a bit of that show the other day, and he was complaining about how, or not complaining, sort of friendly complaining about how other people have taken his idea and run with it, right? So a bit of copyright infringement he's claiming, but he's having fun with it. Following up on, Apple had an app last week that they were putting out for COVID-19 awareness and, you know, testing, or sort of not testing, but like vetting. Canada has also come out with an app on the App Store for those of us who can't get the American one. This is not Apple Canada. This is from the government of Canada, and it's published by or created by a group called Thrive Health, and they're out of Vancouver. I noticed also that BC, British Columbia, also has their own version of the app. So obviously, that I would guess it was made by the same group of guys. So if you're in Canada and you're looking for same kind of information that our US counterparts have through Apple, we have our own app now too. So, you know, daily information and self-check sort of things, and showing you how to wash your hands and all that kind of stuff, and explaining, you know, what the virus is all about. So that's that. And then swinging back to Apple and their face shield production, there's actually a support document on support.apple.com, which is where we normally find, you know, the how-tos and the help information and manuals and documentation for consumer-level products from Apple. This is a piece on how to assemble your face shield and how to make it, how to adjust it to fit your face. So it's got a diagram showing the face shield itself, a silicone strap that comes with, and a forehead band, and showing, you know, a little animation there showing you how to put it together, and, you know, in typical Apple, you know, well illustrated style. In fact, this is animated if you want to look at that, but I think it's kind of funny and interesting that they've done it in the same sort of style that they do most of their consumer level support documentation, even showing you how to clean it and that kind of stuff. So that's cool.
Does it say how to get one? Can you order them from Apple?
That is a good question. That's the $1 million question. I lost my link.
Kind of strange. Yeah. I'm looking through the Apple store looking for one, but I don't see anything.
I think that they're meant to be going to persons that need them. Oh, if you need it. Also, there's a face shield at apple.com email address. I suppose you can contact them there if you need some, but more power to you. And just on a personal note, Carol's taken up the arms of making personal masks for one of our hospitals in our neighborhood. Has asked for 1,000 masks, cotton masks, for visitors who come to visit the people at the hospital. I don't necessarily think they have specifically COVID-based patients or cases there, but, you know, anybody coming into the hospital, they want to make sure that they're not spreading or possibly catching this disease. So so we're all I'm wearing face masks when I go out, and we've been donating to people around the neighborhood, no at no cost. So if anybody wants face mask, hit us up. You know, Carol's using up all the old pajama fabric and boxer short fabric that she's had collected over the years. So I I've got a, you know, a Pac-Man based one. I got a bunch of Star Trek ones and some, I've got a Death Star on one of them. So all kinds of cool stuff. So yeah, we're doing our part to make, face shields for people. And there's all kinds of, there's, lots of, sewing instructions available through, this is the Michael Garron Hospital here in Toronto that's doing the 1,000 mask campaign. But Carol, you know, being a, you know, professional sewer, has modified the instructions and even figured out how to get elastic, which seems to be in short supply, even though it's not considered an essential, you know, subject or matter. She's figured out how to make the elastic to go around your ears by cutting the large size hair bands. She picks up at the dollar store for a couple of bucks and gets like 50 of them for a couple of bucks. And so we're managing to keep ourselves supplied with supplies for making masks. Anyway, that's our deal. Alrighty, so Mark, you got something here for us?
Yeah, I do. So we've talked a lot in the past about how old languages kind of never go away, and you never know when something might come back. And we're talking about computer software languages, usually in the context of Objective-C, but we've talked about COBOL a few times.
Right.
And interestingly enough, I just found an article here on Apple News saying that a lot of state governments these days, since they have a huge number of, unfortunately, unemployment claims to process, are finding their systems, which are all based in COBOL, are being taxed right now, and they're in desperate need for COBOL developers, interestingly enough. It mentions specifically Connecticut, New Jersey, and Kansas. So if you have some old COBOL skills that you haven't used in a while, or have used in a while, and are looking to help out, it looks like there's opportunities right now.
It's interesting, there's been a lot of layoffs in the sort of computer business. And I, you know, it's funny, I know we use COBOL at the company I work for, the large institution here in Canada. But I know that some of the developers I've spoken to actually started out in COBOL. I think Greg might have even started on COBOL or something like that back in the early days of his career. But he's older than he looks. But
he's too young for that, though. No, it's possible.
I think I think he had some run in with some old languages and stuff like that. But I do know some developers, some who probably listen to this show, who have some. Older COBOL skills, right? But surprising that it's still around. And I think that we joked about it on the show before that all the satellites that NASA's been sending up to to various parts of the universe, like Voyager and all those kind of things, they all speak COBOL.
Fortran.
You know? Is it Fortran?
Yeah.
Oh, even older, right?
Around the same age. Yeah. Fortran's a big scientific language because it was basically before we had calculators. It was the language to do mathematical calculations back then.
So COBOL runs on the old host systems that they used to call them, like the IBM 36s and stuff like that?
Probably, yes. Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, get your COBOL skills. Maybe we need COBOL by tutorials by Ray Wunderlich to come out soon. All right.
I mean, before we go off of that one, I want to poke at this quote here, right? And to be really clear, I'm not making it political. I'm talking about failings in terms of humans and postmortems for projects and actually doing stuff. So literally, we have systems that are 40 plus years old, New Jersey Governor Murphy said over the weekend. There'll be lots of postmortems, and one of them on our list will be, how did we get here where we literally needed COBOL programmers? But let me tell you, because when you did that very same postmortem back in 1999 to 2000, 20 years ago, you didn't learn from it. And if you've been involved in postmortems, in organizations, they quite often don't learn from them. So there should be a postmortem on postmortems, I think.
We just chalk them down to technical debt, put them on a list and forget about them? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because I'm sure somebody said, hey, well, let's rewrite this. You know, well, here's what it would cost to make it, perfect and not have, wild and exotic new bugs. Because, these COBOL systems don't have bugs that are unknown. Like, they've figured it all out by now.
I'm sure there's a Jira epic somewhere in the backlog saying migrate away from COBOL.
Rewriting this hot new language Java, which itself is now like 30 years old.
Yeah.
The question though is what's the where is it on the priorities, right?
Yeah, just pick a fancy new language, draw the line and say, start rewriting it in Swift, which is already six years old coming up on, right? Or use Rust or some other like newer language. And by the time you get done writing it, hey, guess what? It'll be like a decade old and it'll be solid. And then at very least, it'll have another 20 years, people are like, oh, why do we need these Rust programmers? Damn it. Like, they're all gray-haired, and now we got to go find them and pay them a lot of money. Why didn't we write it in something newer? And then the cycle continues.
Well, so now that you just mentioned that Swift is now 6 years old, by our own podcast rules, that makes it past its half-life, right?
It is, 10-year-old. You know, it's not quite at 6 years, I guess, right? Because we would be 6 years in the introduction in June.
Yeah, 2014 June was when it was rolled out.
Yeah. But you're right. It is definitely past the midpoint of the hype cycle, the 10-year hype cycle.
But we never claim that languages only have that length of that life cycle. We claim that hot things, hot new things have that life cycle, and languages tend to stick around for a lot longer.
They do, in terms of sticking around in usage, but I think the hype cycle still works at some level. I'm unclear, because my longtime listeners of the show know the genesis of part of the reason for this show was my beer time, or hallway track, I assume, conversations with Tim at 360 iDev many moons ago about my hypothesis for hype cycles, like what I saw happen to the web, and then web 2.0, and what I at the time assumed was happening to mobile. And I think it might still apply at some sort of level, and I'm not sure how it works out for things like languages. And I'll take Golang as an example. It is like 10 years old now, I think. And I have noticed that it's not the, you know, hot new language that people are like, oh my gosh, look how many different, you know, conferences there are starting up with about it. Look how many different conference talks there are about it. There still are many. Don't get me wrong. It still has its place. I think it's matured and it's solidified. And so I would suspect that Swift might end up doing the same thing. And then we'll be talking about, you know, Swift plus plus or something. And then, oh, look at all these different conferences and all these new books and all this new material that comes out related to it.
Did Go really ever take off? I mean, it was always considered a language that, you know, was about to take off, right? And it never did it ever really take off, or am I just insulated from it because I'm not in that world?
It's used for sure, and it seems to be doing pretty well in terms of the containers and Kubernetes infrastructure world. And it's, if I was to call it like a sports metaphor thing, I would say that it's a pretty solid journeyman. You know, it's like, hey, it's that midfielder. Or hey, it's that quarterback that nobody ever really wanted to say, wow, like that is, by golly, that's your franchise person. But this person will get us through. You know, they can get us into the playoffs. That's what I think it is. It, you know, it's a pretty good solid performer, but not the darling of the programming language world.
Didn't it get sort of overshadowed a bit by JavaScript and Node.js?
In terms of back-end development, especially, you know, web application development, I think JavaScript trounces everything handily. Easily. JavaScript is the lingua franca of like the entire programming world when you look at it from that way. It definitely lost out to stuff like Node and JavaScript, the resurgence of Python for sure, and the emergence of Rust. I'm seeing more people talking about doing things that they might have used Go for and say, well, let's evaluate it versus Rust. And it's not like a perfect sort of thing to do, but it definitely is not the darling, as I mentioned before, that it was, you know, 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's not to denigrate it. It is on my list of languages to pick up and do interesting things with. I just don't think it's like the huge, oh my gosh, you're going to get, you know, $500,000 salary just by learning this one skill, right? That ship has sailed for that part of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. What's going on with Zoom, Jaime?
Well, when I put these two links in the show notes, it felt like many, many moons ago. Mm-hmm. So I'll do my best to describe what is roughly happening. So the context is during the pandemic, so many people are working from home, or they are going to school from home, or doing other things, you know, like religious services, like say, and talking with friends and family from home. They're looking for video conferencing solutions. Zoom happens to be one of the best on the market with regard to its stability over, you know, crazy network conditions and the number of participants that it can handle pretty seamlessly when all is said and done. Unfortunately, what has come to light over many, many different articles is that Zoom isn't really well suited from a security standpoint for many reasons, one of which is the fact that it really heavily focused on frictionless ease of use, easy sign up, easy joining of conference calls. It's almost practically follow up to when we talked about, like, hey, remember when they were doing that dodgy thing with the little web server on the Mac so that you could just automatically join? And it was like, oh no, they shouldn't be doing that, especially since they left it running even after you uninstall the app. They ran into more things as more people have, you know, put their classes online and they've done other things. And Zoom announced a 90-day feature freeze to fix its privacy and security issues. That's kind of how bad it got. And
yeah, I mean, like, it's grown quite a bit. Like, we talked about the fact that they've gone in December, they said we have 10 million users, and now they're roughly around 200 million users. So they've grown 20 times, right?
Yeah, it's definitely stressed their you know, software development life cycle and their yeah. systems reliability and everything. And yet we do have things like this other article that I'd linked here about Zoom quickly fixes malware-like macOS installer with new updates. So they had apparently had some sort of installer with a, I think it was a signed bit of code that also allowed them to bypass things that you would normally have to like click and approve to, you know, let it do stuff, add new features, that sort of thing. And it's like, well, yes, that makes it, you know, much more usable, and it does make it a much more frictionless sort of way to set things up. But it's also not that great from an, you know, on the up and up sort of thing, right? And they've run into some of those, like their claim that they had end-to-end encryption. It's like, well, no, actually, what they have is point-to-point encryption, but the pass-through in the middle for their servers isn't actually encrypting data, you know, at rest or anything. It's like, oh, well, that's not good. And, oh, by the way, some of their encryption keys accidentally routed some folks' information through China. It's like, oh, well, that's good. That sounds really great if you, you know, were a country that perhaps might be worrying about the thing, sort of thing. Or if you were, like, let's say, a government party, like the United Kingdom, its prime minister has been running some of their cabinet or whatever the equivalent meeting, parliament meetings, I guess, through Zoom. And today, Google apparently had told its own folks, it's like, hey, for Google Business, do not use Zoom, right? Because Google has a threat model that includes, hey, we would not want to have, nation state actors, nor do we want, you know, corporate espionage to occur. So don't use Zoom, use the newly renamed Google Meet, which is previously Hangout Meet. And then they're on top of that, you end up with things like, Zoom links by default, and this has changed now, but this is all within the last week or so. They didn't require any sort of like securities. Like by default, it was like a 9-digit number. There was software out there that could easily guess up to 100 valid Zoom IDs per hour. And guess what? People were joining public Zoom leaks and using all sorts of profanity and sharing their desktop with pornography and, you know, just griefing, trolling, harassing, you know, students, public actors. And even this very podcast, we realized when we started recording, they're like, oh, there's like a new waiting room thing now that Zoom makes us go through as the hosts join, right?
So well, that could be part of the preferences, because I did host a party on the weekend, and because we were posting it on some public forums, I checked off the option to have to have a waiting room, right?
So I did that's entirely possible, Tim. I believe you, but I do know that there was another news article about them adding that, and I don't know if it's part of the defaults. I think they require a password now by default. So they've done a lot of things to go away from what I think, you know, just giving some benefit of the doubt to folks at Zoom. You know, their software was largely, for what I could tell, intended for some implied level of trust, right? You're working with your teammates at the office, virtual office, or you are sharing something with a friend or family member. What it really wasn't designed around in terms of, not the features per se, because they had by and large all these features, but in terms of the, what are the defaults, sort of these sensible defaults, was not intended for, hey, this entire school district is going to be using this tool from home, or this government system is going to use this thing from home. So it's been quite the whirlwind of a mess for their product.
Right. Well, you know, it's one of those things a problem you dream of having, I guess, right? So unfortunately for them, I'm sure it probably hit them in the pocketbook too, right? In terms of having to roll out these fixtures in such a hurry.
Yeah. I mean, but kudos to their engineering team to be able to turn those things around. And as far as I know, still keep up with all of the demand. I don't think I've heard of anybody say, hey, Zoom is down for an hour, 2 hours, 4 hours. So I give them a lot of credit from the site reliability engineering standpoint and the quick to market sort of adjustments, regardless of whatever their, you know, product management and, you know, user research, user experience sort of foibles have been before.
Right. All good. All right. Cool. Speaking of privacy.
Speaking of privacy. privacy. So the new iPad Pro apparently cuts off the microphone when its case is closed. Mm-hmm. If you get one of those fancy pants, what do they call it? The Magic Keyboard case.
Yeah.
There's some sort of mechanism. I don't know if it was a physical disconnect or if it's like a software disconnect, like a firmware disconnect. But either way, you close that keyboard cover and the iPad Pro will shut off its microphone. So you don't have to be worried about somebody snooping on you.
Well, there are magnets in most of the cases that you have, you know, for the iPad. Like if you have the regular, you know, just a folio case or whatever they call it. I have the Logi keyboard that I was talking about last week. And also they have the various keyboards that Apple's come up with. I think the magnet, when you close it, the magnets make contact with the iPad and put it to sleep. But I wasn't aware that the microphone was still active, which is kind of interesting, right? Which is what this specifically does, right?
Yeah. And I know there's similar things for, at the very least, the camera on the laptops. I remember right. I was talking about the fact that the hardware light is a hardware connect. So like if you close the lid, it, you know, disconnects things. It also, that might be for the microphone. I think for the hardware green light, like it is guaranteed to turn on when the camera itself is physically turned on. So even if there was some sort of software, some sort of flaw, you would still at least be able to know because you would see the green light turn on.
Yeah. But there were hacks where people could do it without like lighting that thing up though, right?
There were hacks to get it to start, but after they did the hardware connection piece, even if they get it to start, you would at least know that it
occurred. Because the light would be on.
The green light would be on. Yeah.
Huh. It's interesting. My 2013 MacBook Air, I've got one of those little, I got a little Tunnel Bear slider that I can put over top of the camera because it doesn't have the green light, but my display monitor does have the green light. Like, sort of, I think most of the iMacs, right? So to let you know that it's on. But again, you would never know on the iPad if the camera's working or not, right? Because it doesn't have any way of indicating that it is or isn't.
Yeah, same thing with the iPhone.
Other than sandboxing and things like that would protect you, I suppose, right? Alrighty. So what else you got for us, Jaime?
This one is a follow-up to, I don't know if it was main show or after show, but we made reference to the fecal transplant method of getting your Xcode support files to be how you want them to be, right? How do I unravel this? So the situation...
Well, I can describe the problem.
Go for it. Sure.
Yeah. So in some cases, you want to support an older version of Xcode for compatibility, you know, reasons across a big team, let's say. Apple comes out with new phones and they come up with new OSs and the support for various OSs like 13.4 and 13.3 are in certain versions of Xcode. And if you're running on an older version of Xcode and you try to do a build to a new machine, you can't because the symbol files aren't in Xcode for it to understand how to build to your device, right? So the way to do that is by getting the device support files from one version of Xcode into another. So this is where Jaime's little trick comes in.
Right. And we'd made the analogy the last time that it's similar to the legitimate, real medical procedure called a fecal transplant, where you have somebody who has an unhealthy microbiome in their gut. They can have intestinal problems, all sorts of other ailments. In any case, the way that you can help cure that in some cases is by getting donor feces from a healthy person who has a healthy gut, and they will medically put that into your own gut. And this helps colonize, I guess, with good gut bacteria into the person who needs the procedure. So I apologize if you're listening to this very show, not while you're driving at home, but while you're eating at home, I suppose. But that was my sort of glib way of describing it as a fecal transplant, where you take from the one Xcode that does have the support you want and transplant its files in a very sort of not as the instruction book says sort of way over to the other Xcode.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a, I don't know if it's a hack basically that we've all been using for many years to make our Xcodes work. Like if you're running an older version. And so this article you've got here has a basically a command line version of copying from one Xcode. The location is basically inside of the actual Xcode version. You can right click on it and show package contents and drill into contents developer platform iOS iPhone OS platform, which shows you how old this is. This trick and device support, and inside there you'll find the various, you know, versions of the OS that you need to support, right? And your article here shows how to do that on the command line, basically, right? From one good Xcode to one that needs the support, right?
Indeed.
And my only comment about this is this works great if you are the owner from a user point of view. If you're admin, if you had admin privileges on your computer when you installed Xcode, then you are the owner of the Xcode. But if you're not, then you it requires a super user to do this for you, right? So you need an admin privilege to do it. I like the idea of using a symbolic link too. That would be an interesting one to try as well, provided the you know the version you have. Like here, it talks about copying over support files from Xcode 11.4 into 11.3.1 as an example, right?
Yeah. On the one hand, I'm of one mind of like, oh, it'd be kind of nice if this was separated out and then you just sort of had this thing as, hey, I would like Xcode. By the way, I'd also like these other simulators. It's sort of a separately managed thing, but it probably gets kind of out of hand to not have it be sort of nicely tied together the way it is as one bundle, I suppose.
Yeah, actually, I think that, so these files that we're talking about here, these if you look at them, if you inspect what they are, there's a like a device support D image or disk image, and I think when Xcode runs, it unpacks those and moves them into your user folder. But I think it also includes support for the various simulators, right? So when you go to, once you've done this and you go to choose, you know, which version of simulator you want to use, it actually does show you the older OSs as well as selectable as your target, right? Your target doesn't have to be the latest OS; it can be a previous one. But when you go to build to a device that's been upgraded beyond your version of Xcode's knowledge, then you need to use this trick. I mean, most people are up to date and, you know, updating their stuff or living on the edge, as you like to you say, right? So,
wait, did you say this allows you to use an old version of the iOS SDK as your target?
I thought
you said that, but maybe I heard wrong.
Yeah. So what it is, no, I mean, like let's say you're running Xcode 11.1 or 2, right? Mm-hmm. And then your supported OS would be something like 13 or 13.1.
Right.
So if you have a device that's been updated to 13, as of today, the latest OS is 13.4.1. In order to support that, you'd need your Xcode 11 or 12 or Xcode 11.2 would need to know about that device.
So the forward part makes complete sense.
What I'm saying though is you wouldn't be able to set the target too high, but you could still leave the target at you know the old what the older Xcode supports, right?
You're still talking about devices, not SDKs. Okay.
Yep. But if you look at if you look in this folder, device support folder in most copies of Xcode, you'll see support files going all the way back to like iOS 7, you know, 8 or 9, 10. You'll see all the various, you know, releases that have gone between where we are today and where we were, you know, 2-3 years ago. Whatever Apple sort of has chooses as the lower level, right? I can take a look at my Xcode right now. Hang on. The simulators are here too. I wonder if you could do the same fecal heat transport thing. Yeah, so in this version of Xcode, which I'm running, which is 11.3.1 on my Mac here, I have support files going back to 8.0 all the way up to 13.2. So I haven't got 13.4 in this particular version of Xcode, so I would need to add those to be able to, unless I wasn't going to, you know, grab 11.4 and run and install it on my Mac. Right? So if I had updated my phone, I wouldn't be able to install with this, I wouldn't be able to build to it with this version of Xcode if it was running 13.4. Mm-hmm. That's the name of that tune. Anything else you want to say about this, Hemi?
No, I think that's been pretty good because it's definitely a thing that I've run into from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yay, I want to update my iOS device. Oh, damn it. That's the one I also
can't
use.
Build to it. Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know why they don't just make it easier to download. Like, given the fact that this support is possible, I don't know if there's any serious downside to making it just a little bit easier and automatic to do through Xcode itself versus
I don't know if we're really, are we really at ABI stability yet? Because that was the problem is every time you update your Xcode, you have to make sure you go through your code and make sure that it's up to date, right? Because they may have added deprecated some stuff and added some new stuff to it, right? But you'd have to go through and make sure your existing code. So if you've got a huge code base, it may not be something you want to do like on a whim, right? You need to plan it. You need to have it in your Jira backlog, as Mark was saying earlier.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it for funsies.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, like you said, like, oh, like the new OS is out. It's got like me with my iPad, I wanted to have the, you know, trackpad support, right? So I immediately jumped on to 11.4. But that basically means that with the version of Xcode I just looked at on my Mac, I can't build to my iPad because it's too new now, or it's the OS is newer. So I have to do this hack, or I have to get, you know, the next version of Xcode installed on my Mac. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of dependency stuff there. I mean, like, are we at ABI stability yet? Can we just randomly grab Xcodes and, you know, once we've got past Swift 5 or 5.1, do we know?
So we're definitely at ABI stability. I don't know how that ends up impacting this sort of trick with regard is Swift, especially given the way that the simulator does things in a simulated fashion. It doesn't necessarily reflect what the actual device will do.
Yeah, something I recall, like dynamic libraries or something are not ready there yet or something like that. Anyway, maybe we'll have a follow-up item for next week, I guess. All right, what's next?
This one is a bit of follow-up related to Microsoft, and I want to sort of ask the panel here about, do we think Apple will follow suit? So the news is that all Microsoft events will be digital only until July of 2021, not 2020.
Wow.
Yeah, so not only Build and a whole bunch of the other ones that were slated for 2020, but they've gone as far ahead and said, you know what, you know, bit of a hassle getting these venues and vendors and everything else all lined up. Like, who knows what's going to happen? Let's just play it safe and do it all online till 2021, if middle of the year, right? July.
Well, it's interesting because they are talking about, you know, that the current situation may, like, we're all trying to flatten the curve and make it, you know, make it have a lower impact and be able to manage it. But, you know, I'm also hearing that the estimates of when this will, how long this will run may not be as you know, every day they have reports that it's going to be longer, run longer into the summer kind of thing. As it is right now, we're at first of April, April 8th, actually, and they're already talking about it running sometime in to end of May. But I've also heard that, like, I think the Spanish flu wasn't, or the, was it the Black Plague? One of the two of them didn't just happen all at once, right? It happened, it went away, it came back, it went away, it came back, right? So we could be looking at something like that, this for this particular virus as well, right? That it could, you know, we may get a handle on it, but there may be a second wave coming. And I think that's what I'm hearing the last couple of days, is that there has to be planning for future states, right? So
yeah, I've been hearing that as well, that they are expecting a second wave in the fall.
In the fall,
that potentially could be even worse than this one, unfortunately.
Yeah, like I heard some hope that it's going to subside in the summer because of the warmer weather, right?
So it wouldn't surprise me at all if Apple did that, especially considering that they are a Silicon Valley based company, and one of the things that in all objective ways to look at it has been quite successful is this area shut down very early. With, you know, relative to where other parts of the country have done that, and we have, yes, for sure, we've been impacted, but the relative amount of impact from the virus that we've had in terms of cases and deaths has been lower than other places, certainly lower than places like New York or New Jersey, and I think you can totally correlate that to the fact that we shut down very early and we're very, very cautious. So I suspect that being a local company, Apple will have learned from that somewhat positive experience, and err on the conservative side, if anything, towards keeping shut down. So I think there's a pretty strong probability they will do that or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, like I think that for Apple, you know, WWDC has always sort of been the main stage for them. It started out with the Mac rolls; they would roll stuff out there. And you know, when they moved over to Macworld, they backed away when they moved over to WWDC, they backed away from Macworld, which saw the end of Macworld. I don't know if you guys remember that, right? I think we might have talked about that when this show first started, but no, actually, I think even before this, because I met Mark in 2011, I think, Mark, at Macworld.
Yeah.
And I think the next year was like the last year, because I wasn't at the last Macworld.
Yeah, I mean, the last couple of Macworlds were already
Apple had already pulled out.
Reduced. Yeah, they had already pulled out, and it was basically a giant floor of iPhone cases. You know, that's
yeah,
that's what it was. And they tried to keep it going. They had the whole app forum thing going for a while, which I did one year and wasn't particularly successful. It was, you know, you could have a little booth, mini booth to show off your stuff. Didn't really work too well. So I don't think it worked for anyone. So yeah, it was dying already as soon as Apple pulled out, it started dying.
And yeah, I mean, the only big trade shows that are around, like the Consumer Electronics Show and E3, right? Those are the big ones. And then, like, you have comic and, you know, fan expos and that kind of stuff that still go on. But like in tech, I mean, even the movie, I don't know if you remember the movie with Sandra Bullock called The Net, I think it was called, where she's like a computer hacker who gets some sort of, and she has to like run away from these bad guys with guns and stuff. That happens every day in development, doesn't it? But that was was actually shot out of Macworld, I think, in Boston. So it's kind of those kind of trade shows have gone away, right?
No, that's really not true at all. I wouldn't say.
No, you think they're still happening? Or?
Yeah, absolutely, they're still happening, but they're just different ones. I mean, there's still Google has a couple of big conferences. Their Salesforce conference is huge.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, you mentioned CES. E3. There's lots and lots of them. Possibly more company sponsored now, where one particular company will have a big show for their customers, as opposed to the more general purpose ones, possibly.
Yeah, that's right. There's Black Hat as well.
There's still lots of them. It's just the Mac ones have gone away.
Okay, maybe the Mac ones.
Just a shift in the
shows how insular we are.
It's changing though, right? So O'Reilly, who has these mega conferences because of the pandemic, has shuttered that entire division. They are not doing any more O'Reilly events. Not going to say never again, because they could always start it back up, but for the foreseeable future, they're not doing it.
Oh yeah. I was talking about before the whole pandemic hit. I mean, certainly the pandemic is changing things for sure. Yeah.
Well, the whole idea of getting back to normal. I mean, I don't think we'll get back to normal, not in our generation anyway, right? Like, how leery are we going to be of everything from going forward?
Yeah. What does normal mean? I guess it's TBD.
Yeah. It'll evolve, right? It'll evolve. Does that answer your question, Hummy? I think the answer is yes. All right. What do you got first in the main meat and potatoes part of the show?
It is about a 10-minute video from the fine folks at Apple on advanced scene understanding in AR. So AR Kit 3.5 and Reality Kit updates, especially related to some of the stuff that we talked about last episode or the episode before with the new iPad Pro and its LiDAR sensor. They talk about that and some of the things you can do and you can get out of it. It's pretty nifty, and it makes me wonder if this is what, you know, this year's WWDC videos will be like. You don't see the presenter at all. It's just the slides and the content that the person is speaking. And my note here is that maybe it's just me because I'm catching up on season 4 of Better Call Saul so I can start watching season 5. But I swear this person sounds a whole lot, or at least vaguely, like Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah.
Really?
I watched the video, and since you said that, I was like, yeah, he kind of does, but I'm not sure I would have thought that if you hadn't mentioned it. So interesting enough, you mentioned the videos don't show people. In the early years of WWDC videos, they didn't show people either.
Really?
Yeah. If you go back to watch some of the early ones,
see the slide and you hear the voice, but you never see a person.
Right? Yeah, it's only in the last couple of years that they started showing people. So I'm not sure this is a intentional switch or. I don't know. Yeah, we'll have to see.
So there's just a voiceover in this one? There's no body?
That's right. Yep. It's certainly easier to make the video if you don't show the person, right? Because the editing is much easier, and it's easier to, if the person makes a mistake, it's easier to just splice audio than to splice video.
Right.
Yeah, like I don't think that this was done in one 10 minute and 22 second uncut take, right?
It's a little too perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless he had practiced it 80 times before that.
Yeah, I guess it's possible.
Yeah.
No, I haven't watched it yet, so I don't know. But interesting that this is talking about LiDAR, because Randy Ritchie has started a new channel. I think did we talk about it last week? I can't remember. Like he's moved away. Yeah, we talked about this last week. He's moved away from Vector. So I've watched a couple of them. During the week, he's doing short, every day he's doing like a short video, he's doing a wrap up on the weekends kind of thing. But so the last two were kind of interesting, and they're kind of timely in terms of where we're going with this. And one of them is that, I don't know if you guys have seen, but there's a LiDAR rumor about the iPhone 12 coming out. Because in iOS, I guess iOS 14 beta, whatever, people pulled it apart and they saw some images of an iPhone with the same similar camera that the latest iPad Pro has with the extra LiDAR sensor, right? So the big question is, you know, what's LiDAR going to be used for in this supposed next phone, the iPhone 12? And also yesterday's video, he was discussing the naming of the next phone, which somebody has reported, I've forgotten who he said, has reported that it is going to be called the iPhone SE as opposed to the iPhone 9. And we talked where there may be a 9 as well. I don't know. But what do you guys think about those two particular things? Have you followed any of those stories at all? I
haven't followed the stories, but it's no surprise to me at all, it would be no surprise to me at all if they put LiDAR in the phone. It's to me, it's an obvious next step because of Apple's massive effort in AR, to only allow that for the iPad would just be a ridiculously conspicuous in its absence to not have it on the phone.
Right.
So to me, it's purely a design cycle, supply chain issue that it was in the iPad first.
Mm. Well, why do you think they brought out the iPad now as opposed to, like, was this a time scale? Like, was it the time of year? I guess, yeah, because April is when they rolled out the first iPad, right?
Well, it is interesting because they did move it to the fall to coincide with the iPhone back when they were rolling them both out at the same time, roughly the same time. I don't know. It's a good question. It's possible that they're trying to differentiate them more. Making the move to iPad OS signals that they want the iPad to be seen as a separate, distinct product, and this helps that.
Right.
So it could be that. Yeah, it could be just an operations thing too. It might actually be easier internally for them to have them 6 months out of phase. You know, so they're not having two massive rollouts at the same time. They separate them out so that it's easier for their supply chain people and their operations people.
Well, it could also be that. Both. Yeah, it could also be that, you know, the iPad sales compared to the iPhone, like the iPhone, everybody gets a new phone every year, hands down, right?
Yep.
Whether they go high or low, pro or not pro.
Well, actually, do you think that's true? I don't think every year, every 2 years, maybe.
Well, I mean, generally speaking, there's a lot of buzz around the phone, right? But it kind of steals the thunder away from the iPad.
Sure. Yep.
By moving it to the spring, you know, the iPad gets its own sort of halo event, right? It's because if you remember where they positioned it originally, when Steve Jobs, he had that quadrant picture they used to have when he had the iMac and he had the, you know, the iPod and he had the Mac, and he sort of had the, you know, sort of like he had broken them down into four different areas, pro versus not pro kind of thing. And the iPad kind of was a fit in the middle. He kind of, at one point when he rolled it out, he said there's a, you know, you have your phone and you have your Mac, we needed something in between. And he kind of like spread the chart apart and, you know, or part of the seas, if you will, and put the iPad in the middle. So, I mean, you know, the Mac sales are one thing, and we've talked about Apple sales, you know, per quarter and all that kind of stuff when we talk about results and stuff like that. And, you know, the iPad definitely has, or so the Mac has its own sort of sales pattern. It's nowhere near what the iPhone is. And then the iPad is sort of there as well, sort of the black sheep of the family, if you will, in terms of sales. And it's been going, like, I think the thing about it is people don't refresh their iPads as often as maybe Apple would like them to, right? So by moving it away from the other two cousins, if you will, I mean, like they brought out the MacBook Air and the iPad at the same time and gave it that sort of, hey, this is now a computing device, right? Spin with the keyboard and the mouse or keyboard and trackpad support and the Apple Pencil. It kind of makes it the hybrid of both, right? I think, you know, by moving it away from the iPad rollouts and, you know, obviously different, like you said, differentiating it with its own sort of operating system profile, right? Whether or not, like you say, is it really that different from iOS, right? iPad OS, that is, right? So I think that may be one of the reasons from a marketing perspective, like you said, and from manufacturing, that they're moving it away from the iPhone, you know, buzz, right? Kind of like when they had the watch first rolled out, they had a special watch event. Remember that? So.
Yep. Yeah, it seems like there's lots and lots of good reasons to do it. Another one would be Wall Street management, right? Wall Street doesn't like big spikes once a year and nothing for the rest of the year. Right.
Oh, yeah,
they might like, they might prefer having two slightly smaller spikes, one in the end of the year, one in the middle of the year. So seems like there's lots and lots of reasons for doing this and very few conceivable reasons for not doing this. So it makes a lot of sense from Apple's point of view, from a business point of view.
Yeah, the punch in the gut for Apple is the whole pandemic thing that landed right at the same time as they wanted to roll these two products out, right? So that's gonna color their numbers, right?
Well, yeah, but that hit everyone. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. What do you think about the iPhone SE versus iPhone 9 moniker? We talked about that before, right?
Like taking bets on this 50-50 chance, assuming that there's not like an iPhone 10Q Mini or something. 10Z.
I'm going with iPhone Junior. They're gonna follow IBM's lead, right? Yeah. From like 20 years ago.
Yeah. I kind of think it will lean towards the SE, but not just the SE. It'd have to be SE2 or something like that. To me, it seems like they won't do the 9 because that feels like a step back. They wouldn't do the Junior because that would acknowledge that something is not as good. Whereas Mini, they could get away with is just a physical smaller. Junior kind of implies it's not quite as good as the senior one. So I think it's going to be the SE2 or something like that.
But yeah, Rennie Ritchie was saying that SE could have stood for special edition, but it could also stand for second edition. You don't think they'll think about it though. Like they've had products before. Like we had the iPad, then we had iPad 2, then it went back to iPad, if you remember, for the third iPad, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So they insisted on it being called iPad, or like they had iMac as well, right? iMac has had umpteen versions since it came out, right? Until they went to the iPad Pro, but otherwise an iMac's an iMac, right? I said iPad, I meant iMac. I re-record that. But anyway, there's nothing wrong with them recycling the name iPhone SE, right? It's just the 2020 version. Jaime, what do you think?
I'm going to go in a different direction. So I'm going to say neither SE, unless it's like SE2, I guess. And I think I'm convinced that Mark's 9, because the 9 sounds lame compared to the 12. I was like, oh, so it's like 3 times away from that, or 3 increments. This is such a dumb prediction. I'm going to go back to the 5C, where the C either stood for color or cheap, depending on what you believed. Apple never explained it.
So 12C?
A 12C.
Interesting.
And it'll be the cheaper one. It'll have more colors.
Well, they had the Mac LC at one point, which they claimed did not stand for low cost.
Ooh, I like that one.
Right. Yeah. LC.
So I like you're thinking about the 12, but the only thing I can think of to counteract that would be there would potentially be 4 12 models in that case. There'd be the 12, there'd be the 12 Pro, the 12 Pro Max, assuming they continue that, and then the 12C. That's a lot of 12s.
They could copy Microsoft and call it the iPhone 1.
O-N-E 1?
Yeah.
Or they could call it the 20, because it's 2020.
True, yeah.
They won't call it the 19.
iPhone 19, no?
For many reasons.
Yeah. Maybe it'll have like an etching of the virus on the back of it or something.
Yeah.
What are you going with, Jaime?
I'm going with C. C is it? Does it?
C. iPhone SC?
No, just C. The iPhone.
Oh, C. iPhone C.
Like either iPhone 12 C is what I'm going to guess. So you'll have the 12, the 12C if you go down, or you can go up to the 12 Pro, and then presumably like a max version of that.
Yeah.
What about they call it Iveless?
The Iveless. That feels like
could be the SE20 as well for 2020. Mm. Anyway, who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? We'll see. I think it will. We'll probably be called SE, but we'll see. All right, what's going on with our buttons, Jaime?
Nobody likes them.
nobody likes buttons.
Wait, or as
nobody loves them.
As Jeff Watkins, former Apple developer, claims here in his title, nobody loves UI button. And I'm inclined to agree. And let's step through this article and what it covers and talk about, something we don't think gets a lot of, love and attention, UI buttons. So he starts out the article with, why do people do this thing? And it makes him cringe, says, when he sees code where somebody has a UI view of some sort that they add a gesture recognizer, particularly a tap gesture recognizer. And it's not like they're doing it for some true custom view needs. They're doing it as a stand-in replacement for what UI button does.
Right.
And he goes through of like, hey, look at all this stuff that you're missing out on, right? You miss out on some of the usability aspects, like UI buttons will change themselves based on highlight states, like, to give you some feedback that you actually tapped the button, right? Mm-hmm. And he also talks about way towards the bottom of the article, but like, hey, you also get a lot of accessibility properties for free for things like VoiceOver if you use UI button. And for people who do the UI view with tap gesture recognizer, a lot of times those folks don't think about that, right? Because it's extra work that they don't have for free. I think those are all true statements. However, I will counter that some of the things that he shows here as bits of code are, to be fair, not complicated, right? It's not complicated to use, an NS attributed string to do some things like multi-line buttons. I get that. but it is kind of a hassle. And I think when folks come across like, hey, UI button, why doesn't it handle multi-line strings like any sane, reasonable person would expect? Well, that's why people say, hey, maybe I'll make my own custom thing and just throw a tap gesture recognizer with it and move on with my life.
Right.
I think that's valid. And the other thing that I think he doesn't really do a very good job of covering here is UI button doesn't handle images very well. Certainly not for like the modern era, right? It is very janky to get image icons to work the way you would want them to work for custom buttons. And I think that's rather a shame. So I don't know how to feel. I think I'm sort of split 50-50 about, you know, do I love UI button or am I probably guilty of doing some of the things that that Jeff is talking about here? So I leave it to the panel discussions. UI button, yay or nay? Hot takes. Do we remove UI button from the SDK? No, I'm just kidding. How do you feel about these different topics they brought up?
It's UI button all the time. I'm kind of surprised that people don't.
Yeah, same with me. I use them all the time too. And I use them. If I want to make a button, like have an image, I'll make an image for the button.
Yeah.
Button shaped.
I've personally never had issues with images and buttons. You just make a custom button, you stick an image in.
Yeah.
So I'm confused.
It gets weird when, like, UI button was really good about handling the skeuomorphic type of images. Like, hey, give it this, what's the 9-patch image called? Where it's like a image slice or sliceable image.
With the curves, curved corners and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And it would do that pretty well. What it didn't, and I don't know if it has done better now, what it didn't handle very well for quite a long time was, hey, I want an image inside of the button. But by the way, I want it to not be sort of arbitrary where Apple decides it goes. I want to control how far away it is and what it does relative to the text.
Yeah, you do have to make compound, what I would call compound buttons in that case, where you have often a clear button with a bunch of other stuff in front of it that actually make up the content of the button. Yeah, I have had to do that kind of thing. Yes. So I see your point about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And multi-line stuff, it didn't for a long time. I don't know if it does now, but it didn't handle it the way you would sort of want it to handle. Mm. So I get the sentiment about, you know, we should use UI button and a lot of stuff, you know, that we get for free that the platform gives us. But I would also say it'd be kind of nice if it, you know, if the platform itself would modernize the way some of these things work. I think another thing that people tend to complain about is the way that UI label handles things. I guess maybe it's better in Swift UI, but it like
it does weird. The first two building blocks of iOS.
It does weird things that you just don't expect. Like, it's sort of non-intuitive to say, how many lines does this thing have if I want it to have an indefinite number of lines? Like a zero. Sure. I don't know why. -1 seems like a more reasonable, you know, obviously this is a delimiter kind of token, but sure, zero lines. And the way it would decide to handle multi-line was always frustrating with auto layout.
I don't know. I'm okay with it.
You're pro UI button, I see. Oh. Living in the past, holding us back.
It's not a binary world, despite what you may think.
You're either with us or against us, Tim. You've chosen the wrong side. Now we know that you're...
Either I eat French fries or I don't, right?
Freedom fries, you mean. To go with the freedom waffles that I continue to eat after the United States lost to Belgium in the World Cup many, many years ago.
Freedom waffles?
Freedom waffles, Tim.
Oh, as opposed to French waffles? Belgian waffles.
Belgian waffles, yeah.
What do you do about Danishes?
You know, we don't really have issues, but yeah, I think as long as this conversation
as long
keeps
as
on
Denmark
going,
doesn't get out of place. Yeah.
Some freedom syrup pretty soon here is what I'm hearing.
As opposed to that Vermont syrup, huh?
As opposed to, yeah, see, there you go. That's what we're going to rebrand the Vermont syrup. Freedom syrup.
Yeah. By the way, did you hear the controversy about the masks from 3M with Canada?
No.
You guys hadn't heard that story? Oh, wow. You guys have been sheltered lives down there south of the border.
Did we end up keeping it for ourselves in the United States?
Well, apparently, there's a large, powerful political guy who said that, you know, a certain company that makes masks that, you know, has a letter and a vowel, letter and a number in their name.
The one you just mentioned 10 seconds ago?
Yeah. Shouldn't ship masks, personal protective equipment to Canada or Latin America, that they should stay in the United States. And this large person had, you know, enacted some War Times Act or something like that. I forget the name of it. But it was kind of pointed out, or what he didn't realize or didn't take into his calculus was that the pulp that's used to make the paper that makes the masks comes from British Columbia, which is in Canada. So just, you know, heads up.
It is a wildly complicated and interconnected world we live in.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Some people need to stay in school and study geography. Anyway.
Are you going to do that, Tim? We were talking about these Zoom problems. Can't study geography.
Well, I kind of got the impression you were mentioning our maple syrup a minute ago, too, right?
I was desperate, to be quite honest, I was desperately grasping at straws for the first thing. I was like, what is like the most Canadian thing I could think of? I was like, syrup. Yes, there you go. Freedom syrup.
So we have this rule now with the social distancing where you have to, when you're out in public, you have to stay 6 feet apart or 2 meters, as they say in Canada. And so people are like, well, how close is 2 meters? And somebody said, well, just carry a hockey stick around with you and wave it around. And that's because the hockey sticks are generally 6 feet long, right? So you just see a bunch of Canadians walking around with hockey sticks now, which we don't do that anyway. Yeah, pretty much. When I was a kid going to grade school, I used to have a hockey stick with me in the morning and play hockey and, you know, in the recess and whatever. But yeah, so I guess that's the measure for I think we talked about, did we talk about last week, the health minister to show the distance or the difference of how big the gap between two people would be at 2 meters. They had a big Kodiak grizzly bear in between them. So they could keep the distance of 2, because, you know, all of us in Canada, we know how big a Kodiak grizzly bear is, right?
An even better way to keep two people away from each other is to have an actual grizzly bear in between them.
Yeah, well, that's what she's saying, like put a grizzly bear.
An actual grizzly bear. Okay.
Yeah. Well, she had an illustration with two people and a grizzly bear between them, right? But yes, sirree, Bob.
Anyway, right. Moving on.
let's do our picks. Let's get to our picks. What do you got for us?
Yeah, so if you have, run out of shows to watch on Netflix on Disney Plus and everything else, and you've gotten at the end of every possible puzzle that you might have had stored in your basement, well, the fine folks at Pluralsight are doing #FreeApril. So for the month of April, apologies, by the time this episode goes out, you will have only a few weeks to go. The entire month of April, you can run any of their courses that you want. And they seem to have pretty good stuff from what I understand from chatting to folks, around software development or operations, information and cybersecurity, other stuff like creative professionals and business professionals. If you're interested in checking out, I don't recall the mobile development having a ton, unfortunately.
Looking at it right now, there's stuff about Xamarin.
Some iOS, because Simon Allardyce works for Pluralsight, or has for a few years, right? So he was famously on lynda.com for years. And I've done some computer science stuff on Pluralsight too. We have a corporate account that I can dip into from time to time, and I've done some computer engineering things that I found here as well. So there's quite a bit of stuff.
Yeah, for me, I'm looking more at the JavaScript, Node.js, and web development stuff, given my day job. And I'm kind of curious on doing some of the C# .NET framework stuff, because that'll also come up for the jobby job in a few years. Well, might as well take advantage of that while I can.
Right. So is the idea you sign up for an account and get a free month to try it, or?
Yeah, and you don't need like a credit card or anything, which is extra cool. So it's not the got you. You forgot at the 30th day to cancel.
Right.
So I signed up for a free account, and hopefully they've fixed this by now. But when this happened on day one, which was probably April 1st, I would guess, it was a nightmare. There were so many people trying to get into the system that you would fill out the account thing. It's like, cool, now go to the link in your email to activate your account. And I couldn't, because I didn't get the dang email for like a few hours.
Right.
I assume that's just from the large crush of folks doing that. But hopefully that's a little bit better now.
Yeah, like I just found a bunch of courses here on Swift Fundamentals, iOS 11 Fundamentals, intermediate level stuff.
iOS 11 or Xcode 11?
It says iOS 11 Fundamentals by Simon Allardyce, who I just mentioned before.
Pretty out of date then.
Yeah. That's true, yeah. I wonder if he's still working for them. I don't know. It's been a few years. He was a speaker at Tammy's conference back in the day. Mm. What was that thing called? I forget.
Indie DevStock.
Indie DevStock, yeah, right. CloudKit Fundamentals, Objective-C for Swift Developers from 2020. Well, that's a pretty new one. Only an hour and 23 minutes long. That's how long it took me to learn Objective-C, I remember, back in the day. Right. Anyway, all right. I mean, like I said, I've poked around some Pluralsight stuff, and it's comparable to lynda.com, but, which is now owned by LinkedIn, I believe, right?
Lynda, alrighty. I think, is in the Russian nesting doll. If it's owned by LinkedIn, that means it's owned by Microsoft, who acquired LinkedIn.
Yeah. Yeah, I get free access to it through my Toronto library card connection, so which I like. All right, what else you got for us?
Yeah, on the, if you still have nothing else to do, let me tell you, Google's Arts and Culture app might be something you can download and try out this new feature with your furry friends. So the update that they have is that you can take photos, let's say like of your dog or cat, and with the power of machine learning, you can apply filters to it to make it look like as if it was done by a master of painting, you know, right. like Van Gogh, for example.
Hmm. Is that why you did Poyo, the illustration of Poyo?
Yes. So this is inspired by The Scream by, what, Edvard Munch?
Munch.
Thank you. I was definitely going to lean pretty heavily on your BFA in this one, Tim.
Yeah, it comes I didn't know once, some of these once, folks. Once a year. let me see. I'm going to go back to the Slack to look at your image again. Oh, yeah, I see. I see the style. Yeah, I get you where you're going with that. I don't see the bridge, though. That's why I was confused about the relationship to The Scream.
No, and I've noticed, having tried this out, that... you know, it's not a perfect process. And so mm-hmm. you really have to try the different filters. And it seems based on the photo, whether that photo has kind of a easy affinity towards the filter will make the difference. Right. So like the image of my Chihuahua that I sent you guys in our Slack, that one worked really well with the colors and texture patterns from The Scream. And mm-hmm. it didn't work so well with, like, I can't remember which Andy Warhol thing image it was, but it was like, oh, yeah, okay, I'm going to have to take a different photo for this one.
So you have to get a new dog? Is that the deal?
Well, I don't know about a new dog, but I need to find a different photo to use. Right? I have to maybe think about, okay, what does the pattern look like and what will the machine do?
Yeah.
Like, even this example that we have linked in the show notes, for those of you driving at home, it's the writer. Writer's dog Zelda, and you see four different styles, and some of them work better than others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the self-portrait by Vincent Van Gogh looks pretty good. The Monet looks pretty good.
The Van Gogh one, though, should have taken one of the dog's ears off, though, shouldn't it?
For the self-portrait, it should just auto-clip.
Yeah.
The Lee Krasner?
Yeah, I thought that untitled. One didn't come out that great. Yeah.
I don't know what that original
She's an American expressionist artist.
So I believe you, but I don't really know what sort of like what the original painting, like I'd have to go look it up. And I think maybe that's part of the fun, right? You can go look in the Arts and Culture app and see, all right, what did this painting look like? All right, now let me see how I can get my dog to reenact this scene.
Yeah. And the other one is inspired by the wife of Leonardo da Vinci. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know Lisa Gherardini was wife of France, but then it says Leonardo da Vinci there. Who knew? Maybe it's based on a painting. All right. By Leonardo. Okay. So moving on to mine. So today is a sad day. I think yesterday, we talked about John Prine catching COVID. I don't know if it was in the after show last week we talked about this, Mark. John Prine, he played at Strombo's house 2 years ago in the fall. He had just come out with a new album at the time after like 13 years. He was 73 when he passed away. He's one of the first sort of famous people I know of that's passed away from COVID. I mean, there's been some actors we talked about on Spotcast a couple of weeks ago, but John Prine's the first one that was personally an inspiration to me. I learned some of his songs initially when I was first learning to play guitar back in the day, and I saw him play at Convocation Hall, which is part of U of T, back in like the 90s, or actually 80s, I think. So he's been around for a long time. Great songwriter, inspired a lot of different people, this is a link to his performance at George Stromolopoulos' house, in the House of Strombo in Toronto, from like 2018 in the fall.
He wrote the very famous song Angel from Montgomery.
Right. Yeah. And one of my favorite songs is called Illegal Smile. And I posted a video of that on YouTube today. And then he also wrote Sam Stone, which is about a song about coming back from the Vietnam War. So that's a sad day for those of us who are fans of John Prine. And last week, this is sort of follow up to last week's. We talked about Swift UI, MMVM. There's a couple of, I saw a couple of books on it. This is a link from Muhammad Azam, who was by Azam, on various things. He has a bunch of video courses he's been teaching for a while. And you can see him on LinkedIn. I think he's on his own channel. Another speaker from Indie DevStock. He's put up a book here on Gumroad, and it's pay what you want. Pay $5, $10, $20, whatever you feel it's worth to get a book on Swift UI model view model, and I've downloaded it, going to give it a shot, try it out. I've seen some of his videos on some of his early Swift UI. He was doing a lot of Flutter stuff for the last couple of months, but he's gone back to Swift UI. That's interesting. I'm going to check that book out. But I did see another one on my travels last week, so I'll have to dig it up. So that's the story of that pick.
I'd be curious to see the approach for MVVM, model view model, because I've seen a couple of different interpretations of that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, you know, this is sort of a, like we've talked about this, Swift UI being sort of a reactive thing. Like, are we really describing the UI? Like, you know, in UIKit, you have your storyboard and you have your view that you physically drag things onto the screen and you create a controller to talk to them. But here, the view model talks lives between the model and the view, right? Like, and the view informs the model, or the view model that it's been updated, right? And vice versa, the model.
Yeah, in Swift UI, what we call views are actually view models.
Oh, are they?
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All these structs that get thrown away and recreated every single time and have these state variables. Yeah, they're very much, in my mind, they're very much view models. And the actual views, we have no access to them except in the corner case of using a UI kit through the view representable construct, but barring that, it's very much in my mind the what we call a view in Swift UI is really a view model. So you edit, you make your view models, and then you pass it off to the OS, which takes care of handling all the actual views. Which actually, as of now, they are still UI views under the hood. May not stay that way forever, but as of today, they are. So the view classes still are there underneath, but hidden.
So basically, Jaime doesn't need to worry about his UI button, right?
I suppose it might do some more sensible things for the button class, but that have to sit and, you know, maybe we'll be saying nobody loves button in a few years.
Nobody loves button, yeah, that's true. All right, well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on the internet as Dev with the Hair, or I'm on Twitter as Dev with the Hair. I'm generally on the internet.
Is that Dev with the Hair?
Is that Dev with the Hair?
Right, what about on Facebook?
No, because that one predates the Dev with the Hair branding. So
and LinkedIn?
It is probably on my LinkedIn profile, certainly for the devwiththehair.com stuff.
I thought when you were on LinkedIn, you could choose a custom profile name.
Yeah, but I think also when I joined LinkedIn, that definitely predates the Dev with the Hair era.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is like Apple, she calls them Apple computers. Like, did you know that they were called Apple computer before?
So that was the BG period?
The BG's period?
Yeah, before Gel?
Before the reprisal of Gel, because I did wear Gel.
Would that be pronounced
many years?
Before Gel or before Gel?
Gel, yeah, that's true.
Gelatin.
We can be easy and just call it BP before product. All right. And Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
Mark R at smupsoft.com.
So are you a big Gel user or Gel user?
Me?
Yeah.
No.
All right. My name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A. I am the Massachusetts Institute of Technology resident advisor. That's where you find me on Twitter machine and anywhere else, pretty much. So until next week, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Please leave a comment on the website, and if you can, please write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is at MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Wonder how many people will get that joke, Mark.
If they were listening last week, they might. but I bet you're going to now suddenly get a whole bunch of pre-admitted high school students who want to get in writing you to see if you can help them.
Get into residence, yeah.
Get into maybe school. Yeah, that kind of thing happens.
Yeah, we had similar people at in university when I was there, because we had like a house, and then there was somebody who was sort of the, usually like a grad student that was, you know, I guess, you know, offsetting the cost of their tuition by being the, or I guess their housing by being the house guy. I can't remember, I forget what they called them. Can't remember which TA or RA or whatever.
TA is typically teaching assistant. Yeah, RA is, can be either research assistant or resident advisor.
Yeah, they had a name. I can't remember what it was now.
Hall monitor.
No, they actually had it. They had an apartment in on the floor, and you know, they were like, they were there with us. They had a corner unit like the rest of us, right? So I just remember going to people's rooms and eating lots of pizza back in the day, or playing guitar or whatever, right? Yeah. Watching the Mississauga train derailment one night, that was interesting too. Yeah.
So I don't want to intrude on your Spotcast podcast, but
yeah,
I have been, since there was the free trial for CBS All Access, I got that, and I've been binging some stuff. So I watched all of Picard, and I am close to being done with season one of Discovery.
So now what would be interesting about season one of Discovery is if you listen to each episode of Spotcast in between, you would it was some interesting prognostication and some predictions that we were actually right about some things and wrong about others.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
were you right about the fact that it's pretty much the worst Star Trek ever?
Discovery?
Yeah.
It gets better in season two.
Okay. Right? I was hoping you'd say that, because I thought the season started off reasonably strong.
Yeah.
First few episodes were pretty good.
Yeah.
And just went downhill fast.
So here's my thing about Discovery, and we kind of sort of touched on this with Jonathan and on our last episode where we sort of recapped the whole sort of two shows put together. But and I don't know if I said this
no
out
spoilers,
loud,
by the way, because I haven't seen the last two episodes.
Well, though, you might get this right away. Like from the beginning of Discovery, I was a little put off by the whole Klingon subtitle stuff, right?
Yeah, I thought the Klingons were terrible. They ruined the Klingons.
Oh yeah, I mean, where I was going to go with this. Like, have you had enough of the Klingons already?
Oh, yeah. Long enough.
So, yeah, that was sort of, for me, that was a real, you know, I had to sort of get through those scenes, right? And the problem is they pay off in the end, which is the sad part about the show, right? Right, Jaime? How far into it are you, Mark?
I have two episodes left of season one.
Okay.
So I'll give a small spoiler because it's already a two-year-old show, right?
It's been 2 years. Yeah, exactly.
They just got back from the parallel universe, but are in the future. Yeah. And that's as far as I've got. They found out they're in the future.
Wait, this is season one?
Season one, yeah. 9 months in the future.
The Emperor, right? The Emperor and all that?
Yeah. Oh, they brought the Emperor back.
Right.
Who, man, she's a good actress, but man, the dialogue. I mean, the writing and the dialogue are so awful in the show. It's so bad.
There was definitely... So they had some production troubles with the writing and the showrunner that I think changed at least once, possibly twice during season one. So it's extra rough.
I see.
It does, to Tim's point, it does get better in two. In a non-spoiler way for season one of Discovery, season two, and the first season of Picard, many times on Spotcast we'll get within the last episode or two and be like, they couldn't possibly wrap it all up in like this next episode, could they?
And yet.
Every time, three times. In a row, they've said, "Hold my beer, watch us wrap this up."
Did they pull a Game of Thrones last episode kind of thing? Where
not quite
everything?
To that extent, but they, okay. But I do sense, feel yeah, yeah. like yeah. The ends the, of each Phantom of these seasons are they set up too much and they wrap up too quickly. Is what I would, you know, if I was sitting there in CBS's boardroom, would be like, guys, just plan it out just a little bit more before you get into production.
Yeah,
for me, it's a lot. The last 20 minutes of the Return of the Sith kind of approach, where George Lucas is standing there with a clipboard. Yeah. He's got all these bullet points he has to, all these JIRA tickets he has to close, right?
Right, right.
Hold my beer.
And there's one thing.
As I meet the law.
Yeah, this might surprise you that I actually remember this because it's a little bit of arcana, I think. But but they should have left it at Worf saying, "We don't talk about it." Right. What I'm talking about. They should have left
in
it at
Deep Space Nine and somewhat talked about in, expanded upon in Star Trek Enterprise. Sure.
Oh, was it talked about in
so? So
Okay. So maybe I'm not up to date. Maybe they didn't leave it at that way back
then. The thing that Worf is believed to have been mentioning was expanded upon in Enterprise.
Oh, it was.
Related to the Soong and the augments.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. I don't think I watched. I thought I watched Enterprise or parts of it at least. That was the one that was kind of even earlier than Discovery, right? That was like right after the Federation was founded and all that.
Yeah.
Pre-Federation. Pre-Federation actually, for most of the show, right?
Got it. Now, Picard I liked.
Yeah.
It was good. The last episode, I think I mentioned this on our Slack that, you know, about 10 or 15 minutes before it was all over, I was kind of shocked and mad that they were going to end it that way.
The big denouement. Yeah.
And then by the very end, I was even more mad that they didn't actually go through with it.
Yeah.
Because if they were going to go that way, they should have just done it and been done with it.
Yeah. I was saying the same thing. He could have, like Patrick Stewart could have just collected that fat, you know, executive producer money and sat at home, right? For the last bit, you know, for the next season. But yeah.
It would have only been one
season. I mean, we know there's a season two. Well, sure. At least if you listen to Spotcast, you know there's a season two. So, so they had to find their hold my beer way out of it, right? So
The one thing I didn't like about Picard, about the show was, I mean, clearly the actor has aged, right? I mean, clearly from when he was in the original show. And I thought it was portrayed well, him at his current age, you know, the character has aged as well. But they had all these flashbacks to 15, 20 years ago when he wouldn't have aged as much. But I couldn't make myself believe it because he still looked like an 80-year-old guy. He didn't look like a 65-year-old guy.
Exactly. And we have that Irishman technology now. We talked about this too, like the fact that, you know, like they made Joe Pesci and Al Pacino and Robert De Niro look like 20 or 30 years younger because they had all this footage that they could use and they did all the special effects stuff to make him look younger. And my other problem with Data was that when you see Data now, he looks like a 50-year-old guy, whereas he was like a 30-year-old guy.
Mm-hmm. He's probably older than that, isn't he? Whatever.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like you get that sort of face fat that we all get when we get older, right? So he just never looked quite, you know, as svelte as Data was, you know. I mean, think back to the very first season of Data. He was like, I don't know, he must have been like in his early 30s, right? He was like really thin and, you know, whatever. I mean, that's, you know, so like a character like Data, you know, like we have the technology, he should not age, right?
Right, he's an android. He shouldn't age at all.
Exactly. He should be like a you know, a white EMAC. He should just constantly be, you know, looking the same, right?
One thing confused me too. Wasn't Seven of Nine on a different show?
Yeah, Voyager.
So
yeah.
Why does Picard even know who she is?
Because he's Borg.
I mean,
they're both part of the same big Borg network, right?
Okay, I guess. Yeah, that's it.
I mean, the other thing is, I'm pretty sure, you know, on Federation News Network, it was a pretty big deal when Voyager suddenly, spoilers for the end of Voyager, suddenly arrived
Earth. Didn't it seem like they knew each other in the show? I mean, maybe they had met or something, but...
They knew by reputation, but they seemed to not, like, have really, truly met each other, right?
This is the point that, remember, there's a scene where Rios and, what's his name, Raffi, are talking about how, like, Seven and Picard are off in his little his holographic, you know, farm or whatever, having a great old time drinking scotch and stuff. And so Raffi and Rios are talking about how the fact that it seems like they know each other, and yet how could they possibly know each other? They've never actually met before.
It's because
he was Locutus and she was Seven of Nine. They would have been, mind you, would they have been in the Borg consciousness at the same time? I may wonder.
I'd have to check the timelines, but I think Annika Hansen might have been assimilated.
She was released from the Borg at one point. Mind you, she went back into the, what do you call the Borg collective or whatever. What do they call it?
Collective? Was that the word you're looking for?
Yeah, the collective, that one collective consciousness that they have, right? Because she goes back in a couple of times. She went back and became the Borg queen in this series. And, you finished Picard, right?
Yeah.
She plugged herself in the ship, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but she plugs herself in the ship. And then I think at one point there was a time where she went back into the collective because she found this sort of space where all these Borg could get together on this sort of fantasy planet. They went to Fantasy Island and had, you know, knew each other, and even though they were all on separate missions, you know? Do you know that episode? You know, we, think we talked about this on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Too,
right? So like Unimatrix Zero or something.
Yeah, Unimatrix. Voyager. Yeah, that was it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there may have been some crossover there too. Or again, like, you know, Voyager came back and Picard, you know, retired and all that kind of stuff. And then maybe they went to some, maybe they went to the, you know, the Star Trek alumni, Federation alumni, you know, banquets and met each other there. Who knows?
Yeah, they were at the same awkward luncheon with the bad boxed lunches, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, bad replicated lunches. Yeah, exactly.
It was like, I could say something here or I could continue nibbling on this disgusting cob salad.
Rubber chicken, exactly. Yeah.
They were both on the former Borg Federation officer panel.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. They were on the Borg Slack channel.
Yeah. Yeah.
X-Borg.
Right.
XB Slack channel.
Yeah, but Mark, I do think given your what now is 60 days of free CBS All Access, it's not just 30. I don't know if you have to do another code to do that or if it just continues.
It gets another 30 days?
Remember, we didn't actually, we're on hiatus. That's right. So after the initial 30 days.
Yeah, there is another code that I need to look up to get my extra 30 days. Yes, I know about that, okay. But I haven't done it yet. Yeah.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. I think you'll like season 2 of Discovery better. And mm-hmm. I think a shining part of that was Captain Pike and the actor that they got for him. Spock is pretty good too. Everybody's really hoping for a Captain Pike show to become a reality. And my hope is that if they do go that route, that they will have that series be more episodic. Even though I have enjoyed the very heavily serialized Picard and Discovery, I don't think everything has to be serialized. I think having, you know, one of the many shows that they have be episodic would be kind of nice.
But he hasn't gotten to the Harry Mudd episode with the big space whale or whatever.
Yeah, no, I did.
Magic
did?
To make the sanest man go mad. That's excellent.
That was early on. Mm. Yeah. That's where I thought it started to go bad.
Really?
Yeah. Cause usually, you know, usually they can get a good season out of just exploring the characters and the situation before rely on the gimmicks.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the standard time loop gimmick or the standard parallel universe gimmick that every Star Trek has done in the past, you know, done at least twice. But this time it was like episode 5 that they rolled that out.
Yeah. Well, they do it for a reason too. The tardigrade thing I found pretty tiring.
Yeah. You know? Oh yeah. Yeah. Another thing that bothered me, which maybe doesn't bother other people as much, but it bothers me is the science was particularly awful, in this series.
Yeah.
Usually Star Trek. So there was like the early show science was silly, right? But it was the 60s. So nobody cared.
Yes.
And it was Captain Kirk. It wasn't about the science, but the later shows tried to take the science kind of seriously and be self-consistent and sort of project what might the science really be like by that time, right? And did a reasonably good job, of course. You know, it's who knows, but reasonably good job. In this one, they just completely threw that out the window. It's like, you know, let's just throw a lot of jargon and make things up that just are completely implausible. Like, okay, there was one thing that just bugged the hell out of me. There was, as soon as they get into the parallel universe, the first thing that one of the tricorders popped up or whatever, not a tricorder, but something, the equivalent, pops up and says, oh, it has a different quantum signature, so we must be in a different universe.
Right.
Well, why would you have a quantum signature sensor if you had never been to another universe before? If you didn't routinely go to other universes, why would your standard set of unit tests be checking for quantum signature? You wouldn't, right?
Wait, this is on Discovery?
Discovery. When they pop into the alternate universe.
Yeah, because they never would have done that before, right?
Yeah, and then I'm pretty sure, this went by fast, so I'm not sure if this actually happened, but I thought I picked this up, that they changed their quantum signature to make it match the other, the local one, so they wouldn't get noticed. And then later, a couple of episodes later, and I'm binge-watching them, so I notice these things, a couple of episodes later, someone said how it's impossible to change the quantum signature. When she gave the Empress her badge from the other universe, you can say, see, it has a quantum signature, the wrong quantum signature. And the Empress put it in a little slot where it said, quantum signature test, fail. Why would you have a quantum signature test? You don't routinely have people going to different universes.
In the meta part of the universe for the show, I will agree agree with that assessment for Discovery because it takes place so early in the timeline.
Yeah.
I would say, though, however, by the time you get to, like, Voyager, all sorts of nuttiness happens.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Quantum signatures where, like, it probably is, like, a slot that they just
fair
have.
Enough. Yeah, it is.
On the, on the modern Enterprise, be yeah, like, yeah. Hey, so this yeah. is, like, not the real Harry Kim, right? No, same thing.
Wait, is he not the real Harry Kim?
Well, he, at a quantum level, he is just as real as the other one who died. However, he's definitely not our Harry Kim.
He's from another timeline, really?
He's from that episode of Voyager where they, you know, they hit some space anomaly or something that split the ship in twain, right?
Right.
And there were two different versions of Voyager that were both equally equally valid, and they blow up one of them, and the Harry Kim that had died on this current Voyager gets replaced, and Naomi Wildman, the child, gets replaced by their counterparts from the other Voyager. If you go back to TNG, when Worf again encounters an anomaly coming back from that Batleth tournament, he ends up jumping between all these different quantum realities, and they recognize, I think the Data or Geordi from that one says, hey, wait a minute, his quantum signature is not the same as ours, so he must be telling the truth. So that's to roll it back to say, like, I agree with Mark that, like, it'd be kind of silly at the disco era to have that, but, you know, maybe not so uncommon in the TNG.
Fair enough. But we're talking about this one. Yeah. another thing that I just thought was completely stupid was when they went on to the Klingon ship. Everything about the Klingons was bad, but when they went onto the Klingon ship and they had to set up the two flashing boxes that had some, you know, some effect to send some message back, you know. You know what I'm talking about, right? You know, I can't even remember what it was for, but they had to burn them,
and somebody went, yeah.
They had to so one of the flashing boxes says, flashing box number one of two is set up, awaiting number two. Why would you put that? Because then when the Klingon finds it, they know to look for another one. I mean,
hold on. So that assumes that they can read English, though, right? Granted, it is done for, you know, usability of the audience. Yeah, right. Yeah, and you can argue all right, well, within this, you would want to do, you know, if you're going to set up these beacons, you want to know. But, you know, if somebody ran into your room right now and, you know, assuming you didn't have access to technology that could help you easily, right? And you're like, hey, what's this thing that's written in Swahili? Would you know what it is? You'd be like, what the fuck is this?
Okay. But then why did the flashing box have to have this like blue flashing light in this dark bridge so that anyone would have.
So that you could see it, Mark.
Flashing thing. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Yeah, they really should have at least like duct taped it or something, you know.
It's no wonder the Klingons lost the war because on a Federation ship, to get onto the bridge, these big giant doors open and everyone turns around and can see who walks into the bridge all the time. But on the Klingon ship, apparently you can just walk right in and set up a big flashing blue light and nobody notices. It's no wonder the Klingons lost.
Right.
All right, sorry.
You know, I've always kind of wondered about bridge design.
Time apparently.
Like why do the doors open from behind? Shouldn't they really open from somewhere near the front
so you can see
if attackers come?
Well, because you gotta look out the window, right?
Yeah,
so not directly in front screen, perhaps, you know, but like, you know, peripheral vision at the least.
Yeah,
and it's a view screen, and yet whenever they show zoom in from outside of the ship, they always come along to like a big window kind of thing.
So
Jaime, since you brought up Voyager, can you explain Seska to me? You know, I think she's a Kazon.
So Seska was actually a Cardassian spy, I think, from the Obsidian Order. But
was she like Maquis originally or something?
So she had infiltrated the Maquis by pretending to be Bajoran. I think she had like the, you know, plastic surgery sort of thing that they do all the time in that era. And she had become Chakotay's lover and bore his child actually later.
Oh, that's who the little kid is, right? The little girl?
No, not Naomi Wildman. Okay. The one with the little horns on her and her forehead?
Yeah, I think so.
No, she is the child of Lieutenant Wildman or Ensign Wildman. I don't remember what the crew designation was. It was somebody who was in like the first season or two of Voyager, who was like a recurring character who ended up having the child later in the season, I think.
Yeah, because she hangs out with Seven of Nine at some point in one of the episodes I saw.
Mm-hmm. And Neelix as well.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. How did Seska come up? That's a pretty random...
Just one of those random characters. I mean, I watched Voyager at the very beginning and I think I must have missed like half a season or something, because all of a sudden there was this contention with Chakotay and Seska, and how she went over to the bad side and joined up with the enemy, right?
Yeah.
I guess
yeah.
Cardassians, I don't know.
I think she makes a couple of appearances later on, too.
Yeah. Foiled again, sort of, Chakotay says, you know. Seska! Yeah. Anyway, that's our Star Trek tangent.
Yep. All right, I got two more episodes. I can probably watch those tonight.
Yeah. Well, we should let you go and do that then. Yeah.
Cool.
All right. I'm glad you told me that season two is better, because I might not have watched season two.
After. Really?
Yeah. Well, the whole bait and switch about the captain is really from the other universe. It's just come.
Yeah, we were. if you listen to the episodes as we go along, it's podcast. I was a very strong Team Lorca fan of like, look, this guy is basically Captain Jellicoe from TNG, but yeah. He's kind of different than the main crew. He's kind of a hard ass. In this case, this guy is like, dude, I will push ethics to the side if it accomplishes what I need. And we did think that it was heavily undermining the gravitas of the character by like, oh, he's actually super evil by reasons. Mm. So you'll get no disagreement here, but it is probably a little different when you're binging through and you can see that hard shift,
the flaws,
the same afternoon versus us going week to week.
Yeah.
In season one, we were watching and then recording maybe a day or two later. And then in season two, we were watching and recording the same night. So we literally had like 30 minutes to digest, right?
Mm.
Yeah. But it's interesting. Jonathan's really good at sort of pulling plots apart, right? Because he's read and written tons of stuff in his lifetime.
Brings the journalist aspect to it. He's way more prepared than I am, for sure.
Yeah. But you have a lot of crazy anime comic book, experience too, right?
It takes a village, man. It takes a village. Just like this very show. We bring all sorts of different things to it.
All right. On that note, we'll say goodnight again.
All right.
All right.
Good night.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.